Support for Science Friday's podcast comes from Squarespace, the award-winning website builder that helps you share your story with the world. Start a free trial at squarespace.com/Friday.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you watch the TV show House, you know that Dr. House can solve any medical mystery just by asking a few questions. The answers just seem to come to him right out of the blue. Of course, you've got Sherlock Holmes and Doctor Who, or other savants in the same league. But this idea of innate genius isn't only in fiction. Researchers surveyed scientists and other academics to see whether in certain fields of science, if they thought raw talent mattered more than hard work. The results were published this week in Science, and they showed that those fields that rated higher in the raw talent category also had fewer women earning PhDs. Could this idea of innate genius play a part in a science gender gap? Carol Dweck was not part of the study in Science, but she's a professor of psychology at Stanford University and studied this idea. She does study the idea of innate genius. Welcome to Science Friday.
Pleasure to be here, Ira.
Did you give us a summary of the Science study and what the researchers found there?
Yes. They had the dazzling insight that a whole field could have a mindset, a whole academic discipline could believe that success required innate brilliance, or it could believe, on the other hand, that it required hard work, dedication, sustained engagement over time. They then had the more dazzling insight that this could explain underrepresentation of women in various fields. They found a very strong relationship. The more a field believed you must have this inherent ability to succeed, the fewer women were in that field. And it wasn't just in science. It's also true in social sciences and humanities.
And why would that be, do you think?
When a field says some people have it and some don't, the women start thinking, are they putting me in the don't category? Women may feel less welcome in those fields and stay away from them. In addition, the fields that said it's sheer genius also rated their fields as less welcoming to women.
Our number, 844-724-8255. Aren't all these fields in general dominated by men anyhow?
Well, it's interesting because the fields that don't subscribe to the innate genius have lots of women. Mm-hmm. They're molecular biology, neuroscience, evolutionary biology. Those are really rigorous fields that require lots of training, lots of dedication. But they don't believe it's innate genius for the most part. Yes, there's ability involved, but they emphasize more the dedication, the growth of your ability through hard work. They've got plenty of women. Mm-hmm. They're half women or more than half women.
Let's talk about the fields that ranked on the higher end. The high brilliance fields were what?
The high brilliance fields were math and physics, but even more extreme than math and physics was philosophy, which is not a science.
And music? Was that included
too? Music composition was included, and that has more of the innate genius view and fewer women.
Mm-hmm. You're a psychologist. Your field ranked at the lower end of the spectrum.
Yes. I wouldn't call it the lower end.
Sorry.
I would call it...
Bad choice of words.
Ranked at the glorious end that emphasizes dedication, deep, sustained engagement, the growth of your abilities and insights over time.
Does this mean that they just don't, the people who work in these fields just don't think that women can have innate brilliance in them and you know, in physics and math and computer science and whatever?
it's a little more insidious than that, because they say, oh, you know, we want anyone who has innate brilliance can join us. We're not necessarily biased. But it leads to a sense that only certain people have this innate brilliance. And it discourages from women from entering this genius competition.
Mm-hmm. Our number is 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk. You can also tweet us at SciFry. What about art, things like painting or music, which seems that each of us would also require innate ability? I mean,
yeah,
you're sort of born with that, right?
Well, we don't know. We don't rule out that people are born with it, but we've come to more to the view that people develop it through practice, dedication, good mentoring. The people that we've heard of, the great musical and artistic geniuses, are people who, sure, they came with talent, but they were obsessed with their art or music, and they practiced it constantly to bring it to fruition.
Is there less a gender gap in those areas?
They didn't study in the Leslie and Simpian article we're focusing on. They didn't study those fields. They studied academic disciplines.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones, 844-724-8255. Hi, let's go to Emily in Indiana. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am in my 30s now, but I graduated from NYU in 2002, and I was actually magna cum laude with a philosophy major. And about a year after I graduated, I decided that I wanted to pursue a PhD in philosophy. And so I went to my advisor, who is a very well-regarded philosopher. NYU has a really excellent program. And he told me that even despite my A average, I just didn't have what he called almost exactly what you're talking about, the innate talent to pursue graduate work in the field. And it was so shocking to me because, you know, like I said, I had a straight A average. Yeah. I was passionate about the field. And, you know, I never really received any elaboration about it from him. And it really put me off it completely. I had to go in a totally different direction from there on. So I'd like to, you know, hear what you have to say about that.
Carol?
That's a great example, because when you think something is about innate genius, then you think you can judge it. You can take a group of people and you can tell them, you have it, you don't have it, you have it, you don't have it. And that's what your professor did with you. Your professor didn't say, philosophy is a way of thinking, a way of analyzing ideas, issues. And the more you're in it, the better you become at it. If you're passionate, choose an area you're really passionate about. Go for it. Mm-hmm. Try to develop those abilities over time.
Emily, are you sorry you didn't?
I am, because, I mean, what would have been the harm in even just applying to graduate programs, you know? I mean, he really just completely, you know, quashed my desire entirely, making me think, you know, I was only 22, so I sort of, you know, was naive and just kind of believed him and didn't question it. So it was disappointing looking back on it. It really was.
Yeah, sorry to I hope you recovered.
It's okay. I'm in social work now, so I love that. But yeah, interesting topic, so thank you.
You're welcome. Carol, do you think this is true of other disciplines? Could it be the same on Wall Street or other places outside, you know, the sciences, where people are, women are just told you just don't have it?
That's a great question. So, yes, I believe it doesn't just apply to academic disciplines. It applies to tech industries. It applies to financial industries. In economics, women are pretty much underrepresented. So as soon as you think, this is a genius field, only geniuses need apply. You're already creating underrepresentation. And by the way, not just of women, but minorities as well.
Is there any way to change, do you think? Is there any intervention to change this?
Absolutely. The great thing about this research is that it suggests intervention. It suggests that we need to change the message that we send to people entering an academic discipline. Our research shows there are lots of women, incredibly qualified women at the most selective universities who are extremely interested in math and science at first. If they got a message that this is a welcoming field, that people can develop their abilities, there's no guarantee that you will be a huge success. It does take some level of ability as you enter, but that these are ways of thinking, ways of analyzing that can be grown over time. Women and minorities would enter those fields, I believe, in greater numbers. Okay. And this is a wonderful research project for the future.
Mm-hmm. Especially since women who've escaped, they've made it through high school and into college. Mm-hmm. And escape that stereotype, now to be told by other people, well, you just don't have it when you do
and
that.
They're being told that in introductory courses.
Oh, interesting. Carol, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Pleasure.
Carol Dweck is professor of psychology at Stanford University. We're going to take a break and switch gears. We're going to talk about why the Earth's rotation, it's gradually slowing down. We're going to actually add a leap second this year in June. You ever think about what would happen if the Earth stood still? Apart from the movie, that is. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. 2015 will be exactly 1 second longer than 2014. The International Earth Rotation and Reference System Service in Paris is adding a leap second on June 30th. Why? Well, the leap second will help keep our clocks synced up, because the Earth is gradually slowing down. And that decreased spin is causing the moon to drift away from us by over 1 inch every year. Will we eventually say goodbye to the moon? And what causes the Earth and all the planets to spin? And think about this for tonight, this weekend. If the Earth did stop rotating, could life survive? Norman Murray is the director of the Canadian Institute of Theoretical Astrophysics at the University of Toronto. He joins us from the CBC studios there. And if you have a question and want to call us, 844-724-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Murray.
Thanks for having me.
Can you give us the Physics 101 version of what causes the Earth to rotate in the beginning anyhow?
Actually, that's not quite clear what causes the Earth to rotate. We used to think that we knew, because we thought that planets created from smaller bodies and that they would naturally produce some net rotation. And, you know, since we saw that most of the planets in the solar system tended to be spinning at about, you know, 12 to 24-hour periods, and they were mostly, their spins were lined up, we thought, okay, well, that's the way it works. But, you know, look a little more carefully, Mercury has a very slow spin. Venus actually spins around in a retrograde sense. In other words, it spins on its axis the opposite way the Earth does or the other planets. And Uranus has a very highly tilted spin. So we're not quite sure what sets the initial spin of the planets. Probably it has to do with impacts, at least in the inner part of the solar system. Hmm. Like when the giant impact that formed the moon sets the spin of the Earth.
Wow. Well, let's talk about that moon-Earth interaction. What's going on there that affects the spin of the Earth? And part two, how come the moon is locked in step around the Earth?
Okay, so there are two things. That there are tidal interactions between the Earth and the moon, which a lot of people are familiar with, the gravitational tides. If you go to the beach at the ocean, you notice that the water comes in and out twice a day, and that's because of the gravitational acceleration of the moon on the oceans in the Earth. There's also a solid body tide. The ground actually rises up and down a few inches twice a day. And that tidal interaction is what's responsible for the slowing of the spin of the Earth. So if you want, I can explain in more detail how that works.
Yeah, yeah. We like detail.
Okay, so, all right, good. So the tides, if you've been at the ocean, they're actually tides from the sun as well as from the moon, but they're the bigger tides are from the moon. And if you pay careful attention, you'll notice that the high tide tends to be when the moon is overhead or when it's down below our feet. And the reason, of course, is that the acceleration on the side near the moon and the side away from the moon are either stronger or weaker than the net acceleration on the Earth as a whole. And that produces a difference in the gravity at the surface of the Earth. It's a little stronger pushing away from the center or a little weaker pulling towards the center on the side by the moon and similarly on the side opposite the moon. And that raises, you know, that causes the ground and the water both to rise towards mm-hmm. the moon or away from the moon on the other side. But that bulge isn't exactly lined up with the point below the moon. And the reason is because it takes a little while for the oceans, so the water in the oceans, to move. And that produces a little bit of a lag so that the bulge is actually a little bit off the line of the center. And then what happens then is that bulge itself, excuse me, exerts a torque on the moon. And vice versa, the moon exerts a torque on that bulge. And that torque is what's spinning the Earth down.
Ah. So it's the moon. This moon's gravity is what's slowing us down.
It's the moon's gravity that's slowing us down.
And at the same time, the moon is moving away from the Earth because the Earth is slowing down?
Exactly. So the way the physicist describes this is to talk about angular momentum. The angular momentum of the Earth-Moon system is roughly constant in time. There's a little bit of exchange of angular momentum with the sun and the other planets, but primarily it's roughly a constant. So if the torque from the moon is removing spin or angular momentum from the Earth, that angular momentum doesn't disappear. It goes into the moon, in fact, into the moon's orbit. And if you add angular momentum to the moon's orbit, which is what the Earth is doing, that causes the distance between the Earth and the moon to increase. And that's what's happening today. That's been measured, actually, by bouncing lasers off of the corner cubes that the Apollo astronauts left on the moon years ago. And by timing the length of the trip, we've noticed that, in fact, the moon is moving away from us at about 3 centimeters a year, as you indicated in the introduction.
Are we going to lose the moon someday?
Well, the total amount of angular momentum in the spin of the Earth isn't enough to push the moon all the way away from the Earth. So we won't lose the moon. Should we be fortunate to survive so long, however, it is true that the spin of the Earth will decrease until its spin, our day, the period of the day, matches the length of the lunar month, which will be somewhat longer than the current lunar month. It's 28 days right now, about. So in the future, that the lunar month gets longer, and the day on the Earth gets longer, and if you could wait long enough, the two would equilibrate, so the length of our day would be comparable to the lunar month. In other words, something like 28, 30 days, somewhere in there.
How long in the future do we look forward to that?
It'll be more than the rest of the lifetime of the sun, much longer than 4 billion years. So we don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, we'll die from the explosion of the sun way before
right,
billions
right.
of years. Let's just say that the Earth's rotation became locked and it was always day on one side and night on the other. What would the immediate effects be? Has anybody thought about that? Like, what would happen to all the water on the Earth, which is, you know, 3/4 of the Earth?
People have thought about that in the context of extrasolar planets because it has been believed by a large number of people in the field for a long time that many of the extrasolar planets that we're discovering will, in fact, be tidally locked. That's the term that we use, that, you know, the moon always shows us the same face, and eventually we'll always show the moon the same face. Many of the planets that we're discovering around other stars, which are orbiting closer to their host stars than, you know, say, Venus, they're believed to be tidally locked via the same mechanism. If the planet were otherwise in the region that people call the habitable zone, where we expect to have, say, a liquid ocean, that could be problematic because, of course, the side facing the star is going to be much hotter than it would be if the planet were spinning around more rapidly.
Right.
And the side that only ever saw the dark, you know, looked away from the star, that would be much cooler. And, you know, just as in the Earth, the sun will evaporate water from the oceans. That water then gets transported around in the atmosphere. It does this on the Earth, of course. And it goes around in particular to the night side. And on a planet where the temperature on the night side is very cold, that water will drop out as snow. And if the night side never gets exposed to the sunlight, if the planet's tidally locked to its star, then that snow won't ever melt. You'll build up tremendous glaciers, essentially, or ice sheets. And you could imagine evaporating the entire ocean off the dry side and depositing it on the night side as a glacial sheet, and there wouldn't be any liquid water left on the planet. That's probably a bit of an extreme scenario, but if that were to happen, it'd be much harder to see how life would survive on a planet like that.
Mm-hmm. Could it survive on our planet?
It wouldn't be very pleasant, I'd guess. It might.
If you live near the Terminator, where the sunlight is, you know, the shadow begins.
The temperature could be more reasonable there, but again, if there's no liquid water, it makes things difficult.
Hmm.
Because the water actually gets sequestered on the backside.
Well, what happens to the what happens to the Earth's magnetic field if the Earth stops spinning like it does?
Well, so that's an interesting question. We believe we have a sort of a handle on how the Earth's magnetic field is generated. There's the core of the Earth is liquid, and there are convective motions in the core. So you're moving a fluid around. But in addition to having the fluid moving due to convection, we believe you need the Earth to be spinning fairly rapidly to produce a strong magnetic field. If that's correct, and if you de-spin the Earth, then the magnetic field is going to weaken, and we'll have less of a magnetic field, and we'll therefore be exposed to stronger fluxes of cosmic rays and other forms of radiation.
From the sun, the solar wind coming in from the sun.
From the solar wind, which could come much closer to the surface of the Earth, and also cosmic rays from outside of the solar system. That's right.
Could the wind then blow away our atmosphere? Like maybe become a Mars if we don't have the magnetism to protect us, you know?
You could imagine a number of problems that would arise from something like that. It is true that having a magnetic field does shield us from the effects of the solar wind, and whether that would be enough to remove an atmosphere is, I would say, probably not that well known, but it's certainly something that you might be concerned about.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can get a phone call or two in here. Our number 844-724-8255. Dylan in Conway, South Carolina. Hi, Dylan.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. My question goes back to something that he mentioned earlier about the slowing down affecting tidal patterns and stuff, and how might the Earth's rotation slowing down affect the way we talk about climate change as it regards to sea level rise? Like, will the data still say what we claim the data is saying about tidal rise as it relates to climate change if some of that tidal rise is just, in fact, affected by the Earth slowing down?
You get the question. Yeah, you understand the question.
I do understand the question, yeah. So there are two things going on. The tides, which you see, as I say, twice a day in most places, occasionally in some places it's only once a day, the height of the tides is set by this gravitational interaction, and changing the spin rate won't change the height of the tide by very much. The rise in the sea level that people refer to due to any increase in the global temperature of the Earth comes from two effects. One is just that if you heat water, it actually expands a little bit. Not by very much, but, you know, there's a lot of water. So if you heat it, expands by, conceivably meters, which is a substantial amount if you're living near the coast. The other effect is if you raise the temperature of the Earth, that ice sheets will tend to melt, and that'll remove water from on top of the land and put it into the oceans. That also causes a rise in the sea level. So neither one of those will be affected particularly by the spin down directly. The tides will still occur twice a day, but the day will be 30 days long or some number like that.
Well, just briefly, I got a moment. I want to talk about your paper. You were co-author of a paper out in Science this week that looked at how the atmosphere can affect the rotation of a planet. Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of what you found there?
Right. So far we've been talking about what are called gravitational tides. Tides means, in this context, moving material on the surface or in the body of a planet to make the body non-spherical. So gravitational tides do that. They make tides in the ocean. They make tides in the solid body, as I mentioned, and in the atmosphere. There's another type of tide, which is called a thermal tide, which occurs when the sun, in our case, heats the atmosphere of the Earth. And, of course, you know, you'd expect it would be warmest at noon and coolest at night. Another effect that's associated with that change in the temperature is that the pressure of the air changes. If you heat air, that you tend to increase the pressure. That increased pressure then causes winds, which move air around. So you're moving masses of air in the atmosphere. That's a tide. That's called a thermal tide. Now, that tide tends to produce, in the case of a gravitational tide, the highest tide is just directly below the moon or the sun. In the case of a thermal tide, that heating actually produces a low tide at the time of the highest temperature.
Huh.
And so you actually have an excess of mass at the terminator on either side.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as I'm sure you're familiar with, during the day, the hottest point is not at noon when the sun is overhead. It's later in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. So there's a lag in the thermal tide in the same way that there's a lag in the gravitational tide.
Fascinating.
And so that means the bulge that's produced by this thermal tide also exerts a torque in the same way the gravitational tide does, but in the opposite sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. We've been talking with Norman Murray, director of the Canadian Institute of Theoretical Astrophysics at the University of Toronto, about the Earth, rotation of the Earth. Thank you very much, Dr. Murray, for taking time to be with us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Have a good weekend. Here in New York, we see a lot of tourists standing on the corner, puzzling over maps. They turn them every which way, try to get your bearings. We've all been there, right? Man, it happens every time I travel. Well, wouldn't it be nice to have an innate sense of direction, a built-in compass to orient yourself to the Earth? Sea turtles do that. Scientists have long puzzled over how sea turtles migrate thousands of miles, but they manage to return to the very same beach where they were hatched. And now they have the answer to how they do that. It's a magnetic sense of direction, sort of a built-in compass. Roger Brothers is a PhD student in the Department of Biology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's author of a paper out this week in Current Biology that explains this navigational mystery. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me. It's an honor to be here.
How did you discover how they were able to use magnetism to navigate?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And as you alluded to, this question of how the turtles are able to return to their home beaches after migrating for such tremendous distances has been a longstanding mystery of marine biology. To get at that, several years ago, our lab group here at UNC, headed by my co-author, Professor Ken Lohman, proposed that sea turtles, salmon, and other marine animals that engage in this behavior known as natal homing might learn the magnetic field of their home areas and use it to return. This idea is known as the geomagnetic imprinting hypothesis, but it's proven very difficult to test with experiments in the ocean. So for that reason, we decided to take a slightly different approach and realized we could take advantage of two things. The first is that there's an extensive and detailed database of sea turtle nesting in Florida, and the second is an interesting characteristic of the Earth's magnetic field, and that's that it changes slowly over time. So we reason that if the turtles are using the Earth's field to find their natal beaches, then these naturally occurring changes in the field might influence where the turtles are nesting. And the new results confirm these predictions by showing a fairly strong relationship between changes in sea turtle nesting distributions and these subtle changes in the Earth's magnetic field.
In other words, when the Earth's magnetic field changes, maybe it's sort of the turtles sort of think they're going in one place, but by following the magnetic field, they find it in another place. Sort of move up the coast a little bit as the magnetic field shifts. Right?
Exactly.
And so by seeing them finding these new nesting areas in sync with the movement of the magnetic fields, you figured, hey, they got a compass, right? They're using it to find it.
There is an interesting distinction there, though. So a lot of animals are known to orient, and like humans would use a compass to walk north or south, a lot of animals can orient to the Earth's magnetic field, but a select few of those animals are thought to actually imprint on the natal areas of origin and use the magnetic field to return to those locations.
Mm. So are they imprinting on these spots?
That's a good question. Imprinting is really just a special form of learning. Mm-hmm. And the two hallmarks of it are, one, that it occurs usually during a very critical period of time, usually in the early in the animal's life. And the second is that the effects of the learning last a long time. So for natal homing, the concept in sea turtles is that they're learning these magnetic signatures of their natal beach as babies. And the critical window is then before they leave the beach for the first time, and they're retaining this information for their entire lives and using it to return as adults.
We're going to take a break. Interesting. We're going to take a break and come back and talk lots more with Roger Brothers. You have a question? Our number, 844-724-8255, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry, talking more about the homing abilities of the sea turtles after this break. Stay with us. Hey, podcast listeners, take a look around.
Chances are, if there's something stunning, you'll stop and stare at it for a while. That's the power of Squarespace, a sponsor of today's podcast. Its platform is easy yet powerful, so you get superior engineering and high functionality when you want it. Everything is mobile responsive, so your website looks elegant in any size window. And because you're a Sci-Fi listener, you can try it for free at squarespace.com/Friday.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about sea turtles and their magnetic sense of direction with Roger Brothers, a PhD student in the Department of Biology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Our number, 844-724-8255. Lots of folks on the line. Let's get to the first call. Patrick in South Bend. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi.
Hey there.
So my question was, I know I've been reading a lot of reports about the actual magnetic pole of the Earth slowly shifting south, and your guest earlier mentioned that they're slowly moving down the coast. Does he foresee a problem with them eventually kind of coming to an area where they think is where they were born, but there isn't actually a beach there?
Good question. Roger?
Well, that is a great question. And there, as the caller noted, we do expect, or over the history of the Earth's magnetic field has changed more rapidly at some times than others, and sometimes the poles will even reverse. So the North Pole is in the geographic south, and the South magnetic pole is in geographic north. And so you can imagine this could pose a problem for turtles when they're trying to locate their natal beaches by magnetic imprinting. And what we expect to happen is just that turtles might have a tendency to stray into new nesting areas during this times, but then their offspring will then be able to relocate those areas again reliably once the magnetic field stabilizes again and geomagnetic imprinting will once more become an effective strategy for natal homing. Another aspect to this question, however, is that we don't really think the magnetic field is the only thing the turtles are cueing in on. So if the magnetic field is to move somewhere such that the beach has eroded and it's no longer accessible, or to a place where it's rocky instead of sandy, we don't expect turtles to pile on to that location and nest reflexively at one magnetic field regardless of all these other conditions. There's a number of things that turtles are likely to weigh, some of them being beach erosion, sand quality, predation, and things like that. Mm-hmm. And also, all these factors affect egg development and hatchling survival, so natural selection is likely to act against turtles choosing their nesting locations only based on magnetic cues alone.
Thanks, Patrick, for calling. So when they get to the beach, do they say, wait a minute, this isn't the same beach I left as a kid? And use other things like smell or something and say, oh, well, here's where I really, you know, when?
Yeah, that's a great point. And it's certainly possible that other cues are coming into play, especially once the turtles get closer to the nesting beach. That's how salmon are thought to return to their natal streams. They first use the magnetic field to get close and then locate the natal stream precisely using the scent of that stream. Mm. In Florida, it's a little bit different, however, because we know that turtles approach the natal or their nesting beaches from both up current and down current. So it's unlikely they could use smell alone to find these beaches. And so that's one of the reasons we think that their magnetic field is playing such a strong role.
Mm-hmm. How far down the beach, actually, do they arrive after they've moved the magnetic field? How many? Is it mile? Is it feet? Or what?
Well, it's hard to know because the way we did this study, we weren't actually able to look at individual turtles and where they were nesting in subsequent years. But what I can tell you is that the Earth's magnetic field is in the time of our study and in the area we were looking at, which is Florida, that it was moving about 10 miles every 2 years or so. So pretty quickly.
Does this study give you any insight into whether we're doing the right things for turtle conservation when we fence off their nests and what else we might be doing?
Well, sea turtles are endangered, so it is important to do everything we can to conserve the species. And this will give us a better understanding of why they're nesting in certain areas. So in that way, it will aid conservation. But what you're alluding to is the fact that a lot of times we'll surround nests on the beach with wire cages to protect right. them against predators. And those cages are very effective at keeping out raccoons and other animals from eating the eggs, but they do generate a slight magnetic field. And so they have the potential to disrupt natal homing if magnetic imprinting is occurring before the hatchling leaves the nest. Luckily, though, we can measure the magnetic fields that these cages produce and estimate what impact they might have that way. But it will be important to take this sort of finding into account when we plan our conservation efforts. We can undoubtedly find some sort of materials that will be effective at protecting nests but still not distorting the Earth's field that the eggs are developing in.
Fascinating, Roger. Thank you for taking time to be with us, and thank you for your research.
Again, thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure.
You're welcome. Roger Brothers is a PhD student in the Department of Biology at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. The UN has declared 2015 as the International Year of Light. The festivities are kicking off in Paris next week, and we're going to be checking in throughout the year, exploring the many fascinating facets of light. There's really a lot to talk about. So we're going to kick it off with light and your health, specifically your sleep. Are you guilty of finishing that last chapter of your ebook or on your Kindle or your iPad right there in bed? Yeah. Have you replaced your alarm clock with your smartphone eerily glowing at you in the dark? Well, my next guest says all of that technology may be interrupting your normal sleep pattern. And he's not talking about that annoying ping that wakes you up to announce your prescription is ready. Here with a few tricks for making smart devices a little more sleep-friendly is Charles Sizer, chief of the Division of Sleep and Circadian Disorders at Brigham and Women's Hospital and the director of sleep medicine at Harvard Medical School in Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome, Dr. Sizer, to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira.
Well, so are we disrupting our sleep cycle with all those, you know, devices that glow in the dark?
Well, we actually did a study to compare reading a book in the evening in the time period before bed, an actual printed book, and compared that with reading from a light-emitting e-reader. And those light-emitting e-readers actually emit a tremendous amount of blue enriched light, which is sending a signal to the brain saying it's morning. And people reading from those devices in the evening are more alert while they're reading it, which probably, instead of making it easier to fall asleep, is going to make it more difficult to fall asleep. And we found that it did delay sleep onset. Even if we turn the lights out at 10 o'clock in the evening, it shifted their circadian phase by about an hour and a half later compared to reading from a printed book for a few days. And it also decreased the amount of rapid eye movement sleep. The REM sleep did not happen until later in the night, and there was less of it. And it suppressed the release of the sleep-promoting hormone melatonin, which is the hormone that helps us to get to sleep in the evening. It's also of concern because it seems to be an anti-cancer hormone. It's an antioxidant and an oncostatic agent, and its suppression has been linked to increased risk of various types of cancer, breast cancer, colorectal cancer, and prostate cancer. So there are significant health concerns associated with the use of these readers. And also people are, of course, less alert in the morning when it takes longer to fall asleep and their circadian rhythms are shifted to a later hour.
Wow. So if you didn't tell them what time to go to bed at night and they were reading with their reader, would they naturally shift to a later time because their rhythm is being disrupted?
Well, even if we put them to bed at 10 o'clock, their rhythms shift to a later hour. Hmm. We think that, and the next experiment that we're doing, that's very interesting that you asked that question, Ira, because the next experiment that we're doing is to let them decide when to go to bed, and we think that those reading from the light-emitting e-readers will actually shift even later.
Hmm. So how many hours before bedtime would you advise that someone put down, you know, the Kindle or the iBook or the iPhone or any of their smart readers?
Well, that's a great question because in this particular study, we had them reading for the four-hour interval before bed. And, of course, you know, many kids, the average high school student and middle school student is spending about 7.5 hours a day on recreational media. So we were not up at that level. But we did have them reading from either a printed book or a light-emitting e-reader for about 4 hours before bed. We don't know which times are going to be most critical. We know that the interval between when it's dusk outside and when we go to bed at night, the artificial light that we get there is really shifting us to a later hour. Certainly in the hour before bed, I would try to minimize the use of devices, various screens, that, especially if you're right close to the screen and it's shining directly in your eyes.
Mm-hmm. 844-724-8255. Call us if you do this, if you're an e-reader at night. Why not, Charles, just change the color? If it's a blue light that's bad, just change the color of it.
Well, that's a great idea. And, in fact, Michael Herff, who's the fellow who developed Picasa, the photo software, he has developed a new product which is available for free, and it's if you sort of search for F.LUX, as in the Latin word for light, you can put it on your laptop or on your desktop, and it will actually change the color temperature of the light that is shining at you from these screens, and it moves it to a longer wavelength of light in the evening, in your local time zone.
You get a warmer color, like an orange or
yes.
yellow.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that we've done in terms of designing some changes for the astronauts on the International Space Station. They're relamping the station with solid state lighting, LED lighting. And the new design is allowing changes in exactly what you're saying, that the wavelength of the light, so that in the evening they'd be exposed to longer wavelengths of light and in the morning to the shorter wavelengths, which is, of course, what happens to us ordinarily. We have the blue sky in the morning, and then in the evening as dusk is happening, we're exposed to longer wavelengths of light as the sun is setting, and that's how we evolved for synchronizing our circadian clocks to the 24-hour day.
Somebody tweets in, would wearing dark glasses make a difference?
Well, anything that reduces the intensity of the light will help. There are even glasses that are available that specifically block out the shorter wavelengths of light. But also you can reduce the intensity of your screen. So lowering the screen intensity in the evening is a good idea. And one of the things that can be done on some readers is to flip the screen. So just in the same way as your GPS device on your car flips so that it has a black background and the streets are a lighter color after dusk, in that same way you can
reverse it
so that it's, instead of being white sheet like the Google homepage searches, it would be black and then the letters are white, and that we expect would have much less effect.
Going back to DOS 3.0.
Right, exactly.
Talking with Charles Seisler on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. You know, that's in the old days in the computers. I mean, back in the 80s, you know, you had amber on black, right?
Exactly. Either amber or green on black.
On black.
That would be you'd be exposed to much less light. But now these screens that are sort of blaring this blue enriched white light right at your retina is sending a signal to the brain that says it's morning.
Mm. Let's go to the phones to Tim in Michigan. Hi, Tim. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, Ibra.
Hey there.
My question was, is if I'm watching television before I go to bed, am I getting the same light effect if I was looking at a computer or a Kindle? Would that interrupt my sleep just as much, or is that a different light?
Yeah, good question.
That's a great question, and the thing about a television is it's usually much further away from us, and so the light intensity that's falling on the eye drops off dramatically with the distance. It drops off exponentially. So when we're further away, we get much less light exposure. On the other hand, the television can be so captivating that we stay awake for an extra 3 hours watching our favorite shows, and that can also lead to sleep deficiency. But if you shut the TV off at 10, it's probably going to have less of an effect.
I've got an experiment for you to try.
Okay.
You know, we have SAD, seasonal affective disorder, that happens in this wintertime. What about all these people using e-readers and getting all this light in there that you would normally get from a fluorescent light, you know, in those light boxes? Are they finding it less? Are you finding any people getting less SAD disorders?
Well, that's a great question. Could you have people deliberately exposed to light from this kind of an e-reader in the morning? And I think that's a great idea, and I should speak to my colleague, Dr. Janice Anderson, who does research on this topic.
You know, or you might just look at all the people using the e-readers and seeing if there's a less incidence, you know, epidemiologically, I'm speaking like a scientist, is there less incidence of SAD disorders in all these people using them?
That would be great. But now, of course, if they're using them late in the evening, that may be shifting them later, which is one of the things that contributes to SAD. So you'd want to really look at the timing of the exposure, too.
Mm-hmm. Is there any software, other software that you could put on your Kindle reader besides the F.Lux that what goes on to your iPad or something?
Yeah, well, that can go on to any kind of a computer. Mm-hmm. It works on laptops and desktops and so on. I'm not sure that it works with Apple products because I think that they block that. So the iPads that we used in this study, we wouldn't be able to use that.
Well, if this is from the color spectrum of the light, the color temperature, and, you know, the sunlight has got a lot of skylight, has a lot of blue in it, right, as you say.
Yes.
It resets your clock. Should we think about lighting in general in our homes to make it, you know, nighttime approaches, changing the color?
Yes, and that's exactly where I think the technology is going to be going. So in the future, somewhere in the next 3, 5, 10 years, you're going to be able to change not only the intensity of the light, but also the wavelength of the light, especially as we move from fluorescent and incandescent lights to the solid-state lighting system, because they're capable of those kind of dynamic changes.
Yeah, and we're already seeing these new kinds of LEDs coming out that can change color with your computer and your smartphone. Thank you, Charles, for taking time to be with us. It's fascinating.
Thank you very much, Ira.
You're welcome. Charles Seisler is chief of the Division of Sleep and Circadian Disorders at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and he's also director of sleep medicine at Harvard Med School in Boston. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music, and our thanks, as always, to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. If you missed any part of the program, or maybe you'd like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcast, audio and video. Starting this week, we're trying an experiment. We'll give you the whole show as one segment as a podcast, a longer piece as a podcast this week. And see if you like it that way. You want to listen to it as a longer segment. And if you like us on Facebook, and continue a week-long discussion on Twitter at SciFry. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flato in New York.